Fridays are not my wake day.
Me too. We're going to be wandering in and out. There's no votes today, so come back as soon as you can, because I have to go too, and Chris has to go. We're all wandering in and out today.
Thanks.
Call the House Committee on Health Care to order. Hey, ladies and gentlemen, there are four committees going on, and some of us have bills in each of these committees. So first of all, we have two sick members today, and we have others of us bopping in and out. So it's nothing you said if I run off and leave to testify in hearing room C, and or if Chris does, or Representative Dembro is gone now. So be patient with us, and we'll try and get through our agenda today. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 16A, and ask Senator Montes Anders to come. We'll then close it because there are some other witnesses that aren't quite going to be able to get here, and we'll get back to them after a bit, but we'll let Senator Montes Anders kick us off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale, and Wood Village. And this is a simple bill, but very complicated bill. It basically specifies that dementia is not a mental illness. This bill actually came to me a couple of years ago when Dr. Maureen Nash, who will be here momentarily, came to me and found that she is a geriatric psychiatrist, and practices outside of Hillsborough or Forest Grove in that area. And she was really having problems with the elderly who had obvious dementia, were either aggressive or their behavior just needed to get under control. And the only way she could do that, especially if they were violent, would the family members could not obtain guardianship. It took a while for them to get temporary guardianship, and then they would have to get permanent guardianship. But in the meantime, these people were handcuffed, taken to jail, and treated like a criminal, when actually that is just a very, very inhumane way to treat our elderly. This bill is really an attempt to clarify the authority that a health care representative has to make all medical decisions for people with dementia. And dementia is a degenerative condition. It's not a mental illness is how we're doing it. It clarifies that dementia is not a mental illness, and therefore the healthcare representatives have the authority to consent or deny admission to these facilities depending on what they believe to be is in the best interest of their loved ones. We are going to have a tsunami of people like us who are, many of us who are baby boomers. Dementia will be affecting many of us. And this is going to it is actually burdening our court systems, but it's even going to get worse. And this, I really feel this bill is a very humane way. Age is definitely the biggest risk for dementia. And most people, dementia is really different from other forms of mental illness in a number of ways, but most importantly, 100% of people with dementia will become incapacitated by it. They are not able to form memories. It's just not like bipolar. It's not like schizophrenia. So with that, there are two processes in Oregon to protect the civil rights if someone has moderate or severe dementia right now. If they are becoming too dangerous to care for themselves due to being confused or fearful or aggressive. And these two processes are court commitment or guardianship. And if someone doesn't have a guardianship at the time of an admission to an inpatient psychiatric hospital, someone then has to pursue an emergency or temporary guardianship and a permanent guardianship. And many times you need to get an attorney. Well, you do have to get an attorney to get this, and most of the time families tell me that attorneys ask for their $1,800 or their $7,500 to obtain a temporary guardianship. And this many of them cannot afford to go through that process. So that's the why this bill is being brought before you, and hopefully you'll consider it very carefully. We did have the Law Commission, I believe it was the Law Commission. David, which group are you with?
The State Bar.
Came and they would like to have an amendment, and we did talk with Dr. Nash and the department. Tina Kitchens has been most helpful in helping us along with this bill.
Thank you. Are there questions to Senator Monis Anderson? Senator, I have a question. This puzzles me, as you know, it's puzzled you. We've talked about it for some time. And this is about Section 2 of whatever the statute is, ORS 127-505, right?
Yes.
And it's a section that says there are some things that these other sections do not authorize an appointed health care representative to make a health care decision with respect to any of the following on behalf of the principal. I think you were maybe around, or at least you've been around as this has been modified. Why can't I give somebody authorization to act on my behalf in terms of such issues as admission to a retention in a health care facility for treatment of a mental illness? Do you have any idea what
I think it goes back to civilly committing somebody in which sometimes people could be civilly committed when they really shouldn't be civilly committed because of people who are not looking out for the best interests of the people. And I would have to have the attorneys and other people speak to that.
We'll ask. But we could solve the problem that you're trying to solve with this bill by simply deleting sub 1 of section 2, right?
It's, again,
I'm a nurse
and not a lawyer, and so we have worked through this, and the attorneys, when we looked at doing these types of things, and I'm not sure we actually looked at that, it was not something that we could do.
Okay. I do have to say, I'm astounded that when I give somebody, my wife in this case, or maybe my son, a durable power of attorney for healthcare things, that it doesn't apply to everything.
It's not mental illness.
Well, some other things.
As well,
you can get an abortion with her permission either.
That's right.
On this, but that probably is not the relevant one.
don't go there.
Senator, thank you very much.
Got sterilization as well.
Sterilization. I'd happy to give her that one.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Chair,
you.
For hearing this bill. And hopefully you will look favorably upon it.
And we do have a witness who's not here yet, is that right?
Is Dr. Nash here? No, she will be.
Okay,
coming.
Well, we'll come back when we get Dr. Nash and come back to other witnesses. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Close public hearing on Senate Bill 16A and open a public hearing on let's do 729. That should be a... Well, if you want to open public hearing on Senate Bill 729. Tom Barrows, as I live and breathe.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. Here on behalf in favor of Senate Bill 729, which would allow podiatrists to assist in surgery. Presently, a podiatrist can perform surgery within their scope of practice, but it's not clear whether they can assist even within their scope of practice. This would allow them to assist within the scope, but also outside the scope if they're under the supervision of an MD-DO surgeon. It's pretty simple. There's no known opposition. Passed the Senate 27-1. Be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Nobody objects?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
I never want to say nobody because I've thought that before. And
nobody's here to testify in opposition.
I like that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. close the public hearing on House Bill 729. We are scheduling some of these bills for work sessions. When are we beginning? On Monday or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do we have a couple on Friday?
We have one on Friday.
One on Friday and then some more on Monday. Okay. Well, let's open the public hearing on Senate Bill 316A, please. And, Representative Harper, do you want to kick this one off? Would you like to do that?
I can do that, or I could sit down there with a couple of other people who are going to follow me either way.
Let's do it.
Yeah?
Yeah, your preference.
All right, let's be down there. Maybe you could. How many people do you have?
I've got you with these.
Do you want to call these folks up as
sure.
well?
Sure. Let's get Brenda Eichenberger and Dr. Thomas Beer. And after that, we'll get Cynthia Chilton, Dr. William Pierce, and Chris McDonald. And after that, we'll get Sue Sumter and actually, we'll try and get Sue Sumter into that. We'll see if we can work those all out. And then we'll have a group of folks from the insurance industry that want to give us some words of caution. So, if you'll start.
Chair Greenlick, members of the dwindling health care committee. I am Chris Harker, representative from House District 34, and I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 316A. I actually speak largely from my former life as a medical researcher and a faculty member up at OHSU. During that time, I was director of the General Clinical Research Center Core Lab. That's the extent of my involvement in clinical research, never practiced or was involved as a patient, as some of the other panel members here are today. But it's clear that we need to make some changes and to the way insurance compensates people who are in clinical trials. And our state is at a bit of a disadvantage in terms of running clinical trials, and this bill would go a long way towards helping with that. The bill does not require, it does require health benefit plans to provide coverage for routine cost of care of patients who are enrolled in and participating in qualifying clinical trials. It does not require those companies to cover any of the care, items, or services that would not be provided if the people were not in the clinical trial. The bill is needed because some health benefit plans are denying coverage or even dropping patients who are enrolled in these clinical trials. And the clinical trials provide a pathway forward to improved care, more effective medication, and ultimately cures for a variety of diseases. Sometimes are a last resort for patients dealing with life-threatening diseases where all other treatment has failed. Oregon has some institutions, OHSU notable among them, and Willamette Valley Cancer Institute, who are doing great work in these areas, but they're at a disadvantage compared with some of the other states. I believe there are 25 of them that have already passed bills similar to this when it comes to enrolling patients in clinical trials and even to get clinical trials established in this state. I became aware of this situation largely through contact with my friend Brian Druker up at OHSU at the Knight Cancer Institute, and some of the people here are colleagues and former patients of his who can tell you their side of the story and benefit us all in that regard. Just one other thing that I would like to say is to address any concerns that we might have, some of which surfaced in the Senate committee. This was the language here is the result of a work group that was formed, which included the major insurance companies, OHSU, and members of the Access to Clinical Trials Coalition. This language has been agreed upon between the insurance companies and the coalition. So, chair and members of this committee, I would support. Urge your support. Sorry about that. I'm not used to being on this side of things, I guess. Urge your support of this bill, which I think is beyond a good bill. It's a great bill, which can really help institutions, research, and patients in this state.
Thank you.
I'll stop there. Should I stay down
questions?
Here or come back up?
Come and join us. It feels lonely today.
Yeah, there aren't many of you up there. You're really off-center.
We need you. Yes. Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. It's an honor to be here to see many of you again. My name is Brenda Eichelberger. I live in Tualatin. I'm an instructor at Portland State University in the business department. I am also a leukemia patient currently being treated at OHSU. I'm here to share with you my personal experience with access to clinical trials, and I will share with you my diagnosis, my challenge getting into a clinical trial, and also the story of a friend that was not as fortunate as I. My diagnosis is chronic lymphocytic leukemia, named CLL for short. CLL is a chronic, incurable terminal disease. We can at this time through treatment reduce the symptoms, but there's no cure. There's no method to increase overall survival rate. Bone marrow transplant have been promising, but it's about a 50-50 proposition to get through that the first year. Not success, that's survival. The clinical trial that I was able to enroll in was a lifeline of hope for me. It was a designer vaccine that was made specifically for my cancer from the genetic material from a biopsied cancer cell. When I was first told about the trial, I contacted my insurance company, and they reassured me that they would cover my costs for routine care. However, they would only give me assurances verbally that I would be covered, and I could not get any reassurances in writing. I received letters of denial and a lack of pre-approval from both of my insurance companies. My trial site at OHSU was getting denial information as well. Thereby, they would not allow me to enter into the trial. This was a nationwide competitive fill trial with 9 different sites, so without the reassurance of coverage of routine care, I became ineligible. Time was of the essence, and the spots were rapidly filling. To get in the trial, I was required to sign for personal payment for all costs not covered by the sponsoring corporation. If I hadn't signed for personal payment, I would have missed the opportunity for the trial. So I had just been given a cancer diagnosis. I felt physically depleted, emotionally vulnerable, and at the same time, I had to go back to my family and deliver the news that I was putting us all in potential future financial danger. I did not know at that time if the path I was taking was going to result in non-coverage of all my medical treatment. Even with double coverage, being full-time employed, being employed since age 14, I found myself at the first time potentially joining the ranks of the uninsured at the exact moment that I needed it most. However, even with that trial, I do consider myself fortunate compared to Judith. Judith was diagnosed with advanced lung cancer, so starting treatment quickly was a priority. She consulted with the oncology department at Providence, where a clinical trial was available and open. They were eager to enroll her. She was eager to begin, and they contacted her insurance company. They had not yet authorized the trial. Even though it would be more economical because the carrier would not have to pay for the drug, and that would have been covered by the manufacturer. That's what her doctor wanted her to do. That's what she wanted to do. But time kept slipping away, waiting for the insurance company to respond. Over the several days that followed, Judith developed bone pain. That necessitated radiation and further delayed any initiation of chemo. The rapid progression for Judith made her ineligible at that point for the trial. Would the trial have helped her? Maybe. Maybe not. But whose decision was that to make? Would you think Judith's, her doctor, her loved ones? The decision was ultimately made due to the delay in the paperwork. And what could have been gained by Judith's participation in the trial? We will never know, because when I first shared her story with you last July, she was with us and she no longer is. One of the courses I teach at Portland State is business ethics and the concept of social responsibility. Responsibility means balancing the need of all stakeholders, your patients, doctors, businesses, government, and society as a whole. Assuring coverage of standard care is in everyone's best interest. Everyone wants to improve medical care and find cures. No one wants to deny the doctor's orders. It's the process here that needs clarification. We need to reduce the coverage confusion, the waiting times for approval, to increase the support for our patients and for our doctors seeking cures that will benefit each and every one of us and our loved ones. We need to increase access to clinical trials by guaranteeing coverage of the standard routine care costs through passage of Senate Bill 316. It's the responsible action to take. It's the right action to take. And the coalition and I thank you for your support, Senate Bill 316.
Thank you. Any questions?
Brenda is a constituent of mine, and I just want to applaud her. She has been a tireless advocate for this for a long time now. So, I mean, she deserves, I mean, obviously public testimony, but she deserves more than that with some very public recognition of her tireless and ardent work on this. So, bless
you. Thank you. Thank you.
We're close.
Thank
yes.
you. Dr. Beard?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Baer. I'm Associate Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology at OHSU. I'm also Deputy Director of the OHSU Knight Cancer Institute, and I run the prostate cancer program. I've taken care of men with prostate cancer for my entire career in oncology. I'm also a constituent of Representative Cannons, and my daughters would be really excited that I got to testify in front of a committee sitting on. They remember him from walking our neighborhood a few years back. OHSU strongly supports Senate Bill 316A because it protects patients participating in clinical trials and removes the barriers to important medical research. Clinical trials offer a way for patients to get improved care, potentially more effective treatments, and possibly even cures. Clinical trials represent hope for many patients with advanced cancer. However, some insurance companies, as you've heard, have used participation in clinical trials as a reason to delay or even deny coverage for routine care. Even if patients are eventually approved for coverage for their routine care, the initial delay in coverage can create significant disincentives, fear, and can occasionally preclude patients from ever participating in the trials that they were interested in. This legislation, I believe, is critical to removing these types of delays and denials, which is often a major disincentive for participation in clinical trials. It's also important to note that this bill is cost neutral for insurers because it simply clarifies that insurance companies in this state must continue to cover the routine costs of care that the beneficiaries for their beneficiaries who choose to enroll in clinical trials. These routine costs of care are incurred by insurance companies whether or not a patient participates in a clinical trial based on the treatment that is necessary for their condition. I'd like to speak for a moment, if I might, about the value of research in general, because it so strongly underscores the importance of supporting clinical trials in the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon has made a major investment in medical research in the form of the Oregon Opportunity, a $600 million public-private campaign. The state contribution of $200 million in bond proceeds has allowed OHSU to invest in the recruitment of faculty and the infrastructure in ways that have advanced the quality of care and the breadth and depth of our research. This can be measured in a number of ways. One way is the $300 million per year in research grants and awards that OHSU earned last year alone, and more than 4,500 research projects that are currently underway. And, for example, the fact that in 2006, OHSU was one of only 12 research institutions nationally to receive a $55 million grant from the National Institutes of Health to advance translational research. Translational research is the process in which we take advances from the laboratory and apply them to patient settings, hopefully advancing treatments for diseases that have inadequate treatments today. Perhaps most importantly, clinical trials allow patients access to new and potentially more effective treatments. That was certainly the case for patients of my colleague, Dr. Brian Drucker, and his breakthrough drug, Gleevec. This discovery has not only vastly improved the prognosis and survival rate for patients with chronic myeloid leukemia and other cancers, but it's become a model worldwide for cancer researchers who seek to understand what's wrong when cancer develops and targeted directly with very specific interventions. The visionary work of Dr. Drucker and other researchers at OHSU was, of course, the inspiration for the generous gift made by Phil and Penny Knight to advance cancer research in this state. However, without this legislation, Oregon will remain at a competitive disadvantage relative to other states when it comes to hosting clinical trials. Currently, one of the most expensive components of a trial can be patient recruitment, and this problem is compounded in Oregon by patient fears of insurance coverage denials. As a result, many patients are forced to opt out of trials that could actually improve their health. This artificial limit on patient participation hurts Oregon patients and makes Oregon an unattractive partner for clinical research, not only for pharmaceutical companies, but for private foundation funders like the American Cancer Society and government sources of support such as the NIH. 25 states, as you've heard, have enacted legislation requiring insurance coverage for routine costs of care. To date, Oregon has not, and this bill is designed to address that. Right now in Oregon clinical trials, there is a high percentage of Medicare and Medicaid patients because these two government plans cover the costs associated with routine costs of care. Non-Medicare and Medicaid patients are often unable to pay their routine costs of care out of pocket and may not be able to participate in clinical trials. In addition to the effects on those patients, this can actually skew the results of the trials that we conduct here in Oregon, as we're unable to recruit populations of patients that are representative of the overall populations affected by the disease.
Can you wrap it up, Dr. Beer, please?
I'll just say that at the Knight Cancer Institute at OHSU, we've recruited physicians and researchers to advance cancer care, and we very much appreciate your support for this bill to help us be competitive with other states nationwide.
Any questions?
Just a comment first. Hello to your daughters. Pass that on. And then, you know, I suspect that this legislation touches many people in this room and statewide personally. I know it touches me and my family. As some of you know, my mother is a cancer patient. She has multiple myeloma and is currently doing very well, but it's a rare incurable cancer, and I expect it to be back. And one of her, you know, remaining options is likely to be clinical trial, and the effect that this has on potential patients. I mean, this is something that she very much thinks about, the potential that she would be eligible for a clinical trial but would struggle to get the routine costs paid for under her insurance. And this is a very real issue, and I'm so grateful to the many advocates who have worked on this issue over the last couple of years, and really look forward to supporting it here today.
I have a question, if you may. As you know, I was both a clinical chair at OHSU and prior to that, director of research for Kaiser Permanente. And in the position as research director at Kaiser Permanente, I had to deal with both sides of the issue. I had to try and get the research funding, and then I had to try and make sure that Kaiser, essentially, in that case, was protected in that it was only paying routine costs. I mean, that was a sort of commitment as a corporate officer I had to the insurance plan, is that... Yeah, we'll make sure the sponsors pay the research part and you guys pay the routine clinical part. Do you have problems, or are you really attuned when you negotiate a contract with a sponsor, which could be NIH or it could be a drug company or it could be the Lymphoma Research Society, which I'm working on now in Oregon, that they really do pay their fair share of the costs that are literally research costs as opposed to routine clinical costs?
I think by and large they do, and we've gotten quite good at negotiating those contracts. I also think that having a clear bill like this will help us in doing that.
I was reminded of this issue when I saw my oncologist for a routine 3-month visit at one point and said, should I have a scan between now and the next visit? And she said, no, I would say routine once every 6 months is fine. If you were in a clinical trial, I would have you get a scan every 3 months so I could follow the progress in a very specific way. And that made me wonder, okay, if I had that scan every 3 months, would that be a routine healthcare cost, which I think you could argue it was, or would that be a research cost? And how do we... How do we make sure we're dealing with this in a fair-handed way?
Well, you've identified a difficult issue that I think could easily represent not the difference between a clinical trial and routine care, but the difference between one oncologist and another. As you know, the standard of care can be somewhat broadly defined in the community. I think the one clear way to address this is through the intent of the procedure. So if a visit or a test is designed to examine the health of the patient or the status of the cancer, that's clinical care. If a test is designed to measure blood levels of the drug or do something else that's specifically for research, that's clearly not routine care. But I will defer to some of the other folks that might testify on those specifics, as I was not involved in the panel that negotiated on this specific bill.
Well, thank you very much for being here. We really appreciate that. See, who's on deck?
Can I just pull up an extra chair?
Yep.
And get all four on deck.
Cynthia Chilton, is it, or? Sometimes I'm not sure I'm reading it correctly.
Chilton.
It is Chilton. Dr. William Pierce, Chris McDonald, and maybe Sue Sumter can sort of back up. And incidentally, Dr. Pierce, one of my colleagues here said, make sure I was very mean to you today.
That's great. That should be a lot of fun.
Any order.
Good afternoon, Chair Greenlick and members of the committee. My name is Cynthia Chilton. I live in Portland, Oregon, and I've spent 22 years as a benefits consultant designing and managing private and public sector employee health plans. I'm quite familiar with the intricacies of the health insurance industry. I'm here today representing the Access to Clinical Trials Coalition and to testify in support of SB 316A. I believe that additional protections are needed to preserve the insurance benefits of patients who participate in clinical trials in this state. SB 316 is needed for clarity. As you are probably aware, insurance contracts are inherently complex. In particular, the exclusion provisions pertaining to, quote, experimental and investigational, unquote, services are typically lengthy and highly technical. Even as an experienced insurance professional, I struggle to discern exactly how participation in a clinical trial may affect an individual's insurance benefits for routine care services that would otherwise be covered. The resulting ambiguity makes it difficult for patients to know what to expect from their insurance. Customer service departments may simply state that the policy doesn't cover clinical trials, but that doesn't address the benefits for routine care costs. In fact, many trial candidates are told that trial participation would void coverage for their condition. While routine care costs may ultimately be approved on appeal, the delays associated with confirming coverage are unacceptable. SB 316 will require that patients have accurate and timely information about how their participation in a clinical trial will affect their insurance benefits. Senate Bill 316 will set a standard for coverage of routine care costs in clinical trials. Coverage for these costs varies from insurer to insurer, leaving patients exposed to considerable uncertainty. Medicare, and as you've heard, 25 other states have deemed it necessary to spell out the fact that participation in clinical trials does not void existing insurance coverage for those services. Senate Bill 316 will set a consistent and explicit standard for coverage of routine care costs in Oregon. And finally, as you've heard, Senate Bill 316 is intended to be cost neutral to insurers. The routine care costs addressed by this legislation are associated with care that would be provided for specific diagnoses regardless of participation in a clinical trial. We appreciate our collaboration with representatives from the insurance industry. We solicited their input on our initial draft language and participated in a working group convened by the Senate Health Care Committee. After productive conversations with the insurance industry, an amendment was adopted to clarify our legislative intent to ensure the bill would be cost neutral to insurers. Under this legislation, clinical trial sponsors will retain responsibility for all trial-related costs, including those associated with any complications solely attributable to the trial. As such, Senate Bill 316 will require insurers to provide no more than is already promised under the terms of their existing insurance contracts with patients. Senate Bill 316 is essential to protect the rights of patients in clinical trials, and I urge your support.
Thank you. Next.
Hello, I am William Bud Pierce. I'm a physician. I'm here representing the OMA, and we're strongly in support of Senate Bill 316. I'm a medical oncologist. I've been in practice in Salem for about 15 years. I started doing clinical trials about 20 years ago at UCLA, wrote a number of them, ran a number of them, came to private practice, have been involved with clinical trials in our practice in Salem, and I sit on the OHSU Protocol Review Committee, where I'll be tonight reviewing protocols for the Cancer Center. I want to put a little different twist on the clinical trials, and we've heard a lot about the individual patient benefit, but I think what you haven't heard is how we benefit as a society. If we cannot move forward with clinical trials, the treatments we have today will be the treatments we'll have forever, and we will not make advances. When I talk to patients about clinical trials, I tell them they're participating in human experimentation, of which the result is not known. The result of participation could be no benefit, which is common. It could be detrimental, even potentially leading to death, which is unusual but possible. And there's a small but real chance that this will help the individual patient. So the clinical trial is not set up so much to help an individual patient as it is set up to help our chairman, our committee members, me, my family. And every clinical trial, whether it result in a positive outcome, we get a benefit, or a failed outcome, it advances scientific knowledge. So we need to keep going, or we'll forever be stuck at this level of practice. In terms of our funding for clinical trials, we have a four-legged stool. I know you have a two-legged stool, but we have a four-legged stool, and we want to keep it. The first leg of the stool are the people who want to bring the item or drug forward. In oncology, it takes a lot of money to take an idea to the lab, to animals, and then finally to bring it to human beings. That takes a lot of money. And the companies that bring these products forward spend a lot of money, and they want to make a lot of money, but they spend a lot to bring this forward. The second leg of our stool to fund this is really the government. The government, state and federal government, give grants, they build medical schools, they provide support for academicians, so that's a very important part of our support network. The third part of our support network or stool leg is philanthropy. There are foundations at OHSU, there are national foundations, I'll be in the Relay for Life, and hopefully we'll raise about $300 million nationwide this year for the Cancer Society. Cancer Society gives big grants to researchers in cancer to do clinical trials, advance scientific knowledge. And the fourth and very important leg of our financial support are the insurance companies. We have to have them pay for some of the cost of patient care during trials. And so by having all four components of our support network, including insurance support, which is part of SB 316, we can continue to have our trials. To answer the questions that Dr. Beer had regarding from our Chairman Greenlick, in oncology, we have very good clinical standards, the National Conference of Cancer Network, and it talks about the acceptable treatment options, standard, and it even talks about follow-ups, and some of this gets into how many scans and et cetera, and we're very interested in the practice of oncology to define standards that should be followed not only in treatment but into follow-up. So I think there's ways to bring those in so that you're not doing 100 CAT scans where one is the standard. So these are being very well defined in many ways. So I think that information is out there scientifically. And your other question, Chairman? Okay. So that was that. What I would. The other part is, how do we know that they're not, the companies are not writing in extra studies that the insurance company is going to pay for? When we go over the clinical trial protocol reviews, that's one thing we're really looking at as a committee. So we'll sit around and say, well, an MRI is not indicated. The company needs to pay for the MRI. Tonight, one of the trials I'll review requires a dozen EKGs the first week to look for cardiac effects. The trial has to pay for the EKGs. That is not a standard part of medical care. So if everyone follows the rules and does what they should, this will be affordable, and SB 316 should be approved.
Thank you very much.
He did it without notes. I'm impressed. Good afternoon, Chairman Greenlee.
Probably couldn't read his own writing.
I know, maybe. And members of the committee, my name is Chris McDonald, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon and Southwest Washington affiliate of Susan G. Komen for the Cure. And I'm here to emphasize the importance of this legislation and to acknowledge the support of this bill from our local affiliate as well as our national organization. Komen is part of a global organization made up of 125 affiliates, and our mission is to save lives and end breast cancer forever by empowering people and ensuring quality care for all and energizing science that will find the cures. In February of 2008, when our coalition was just beginning, I had the privilege of testifying with Dr. Drucker and at an informational hearing, and today I'm here to talk about and be a voice of our coalition and explain how much we have grown. And if you'll indulge me just for a moment, I want to explain and tell you who are the cancer and non-cancer related groups that are supporting and who are our partners. Very quickly, it's the American Cancer Society, the American Diabetes Society, American Heart Association, the Arthritis Foundation of Oregon, Candlelighters Children with Cancer, the Cascade AIDS Project, Lance Armstrong Foundation, Legacy Health System, Leukemia and Lymphoma Society of Oregon, Molly's Fund, which is lupus, MS Society of Oregon, our affiliate, OHSU and the Knight Cancer Institute, Pancreatic Cancer Action Network, Providence Health Systems, and the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance for 2009.
Chris, I need to add one to that. As president of the Lymphoma Research Society of Oregon, the Foundation of Oregon, I got word from New York to make sure I help pass this bill.
Terrific. We'll add you to the list. The other thing, I don't want to repeat what others have said, but clinical trials are seen as a priority for our organization and others, specifically as it pertains to the recruitment of underserved populations. So just wanted to get that in there as well. So thank you for your consideration and support.
Mr. Chair and member of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. My name is Sue Sumter, and I'm the Vice President of Candlelighters for Children with Cancer. I am a member of the National Cancer Institute Consumer Advocates in Research and Patient Services Manager of the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'm also a board member of the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, and I know Representative Cannon's mother very well from our multiple myeloma support group and education programs. My son, Andrew, was 4 when he was diagnosed with a high-risk, poor prognosis form of leukemia. 25 years ago, he would have died. Nowadays, thanks to knowledge that we have gained through clinical trials, our understanding of how to treat childhood cancer has dramatically reversed those mortality statistics. Whereas 80% of children used to die, now 80 to 90% of children will be cured. This would not have happened without enrolling the majority of children in the country in clinical trials. Andrew was treated on a clinical trial protocol and also took part in a National Cancer Institute study on cognitive remediation at Dornbecker Children's Hospital. This study helped mitigate some of the unfortunate long-term side effects of treatment that caused brain damage and profoundly impacted the lives of many Oregon childhood cancer survivors who took part in this clinical trial and resulted in improved school performances for them. Ready access to clinical trials improves the lives of countless Oregonians by enhancing our knowledge of effective treatments and new therapies. By passing this bill, you will ensure that no patient turns down the opportunity to take part in a clinical trial due to fear of the possible economic impact because they may have to pay for their standard care. This is clearly an inequity when the health insurance companies would have to pay for the patient's standard care if they weren't part of the trial anyway. My son is now 18 and about to graduate from Wesleyan High School. He is alive today because of children who've taken part in clinical trials in the past, and he is able to graduate high school because of a clinical trial that helped him with his learning. I urge you to pass this bill so that all Oregonians have access to clinical trials without fear of the economic consequences, and to help make Oregon an attractive to companies willing to invest money in our state to fund clinical trials. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you all very much for coming today. We have John Powell, Fawn McNeely, and Dave Fiskum join us.
We'll let the oldest go first.
Oh, Vaughn, that would be you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. And if I might, with your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, tell you about one of the scoundrels who just testified. He doesn't know I know him, but in 1999, my dad was terminal with cancer. And I called Dr. Pierce because I'd heard good things about him. And I told him, in fact, I called, and I was talking to a nurse, and she said, just a minute, he's right here. And he picked up the phone. And I told him the story that my dad was terminal. I didn't expect a miracle, but he doesn't have an appetite. Is there anything you can do? And he says, get him in here. I can do something for him. He lived about 40 miles from here, and I drove him to Salem, saw Dr. Pierce. He gave him an injection. We had milkshakes on the way out of town, and he ate regularly until he passed away. So you had a scoundrel here, in my opinion.
I was warned about that in advance by one of our staff. So.
Mr. Chairman and members, OHSU contacted the insurance industry in the interim, and we met a couple times, discussed the bill, and worked continuously during the session with them. Susie with OHSU is a hero on this bill as well. What she has gone through on the wording and keeping their end of this bargain was remarkable. She's been hounded and pounded, and as you can see, she looks very good for what she's gone through, but She really, along with Brian Boehringer, who used to represent OHSU.
He's both, going to the dark side now.
Right. They both have done very, very good work on this bill. And from the insurance side, we're here to support the bill, and we think it is important for the future of research and for the ability of both the payers and the patients to know where they stand going into these trials. So we would stand in full support of the bill.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, I think we're here to do what you said, which is utter words of caution, but I won't do that. For the record, Dave Fiske, I'm here for Providence Health System, which includes our hospital system as well as the health plan. I'm happy to learn, Mr. Chair, that if you happen to leave the hearing room while I'm speaking, you're not mad at me, and that'll be a pleasure for me to know that. John's right.
Because I'm mad at John.
I understand. John is right. There are at least two organizations, groups, individuals who deserve credit for bringing this bill to you. One is OHSU, and they did come to us early in the process, and we're willing to work out the changes. And I should add that Senator Devlin played a key role in being a leader of the work group on the Senate side, and he deserves credit for that, even though he couldn't be here today. I believe he's ill. So he deserves credit for the work group product you see before you. We're in full support of it. It's important for me to be here on behalf of Providence to say that from one particular perspective. As you know, Providence is a health system with a hospital service arm, if you will, as well as an insurance arm. And I watched a very intensive, sometimes friendly, sometimes tense debates inside our system before coming to a position of consensus on this bill. And that's laudable. It's good debates that we have in our system, and this was another example of a very good debate we had before we came here and worked on this bill in a collaborative fashion. We're in full support of it. We would urge your passage of it, and if you have any questions, we'll be pleased to try to answer them. I should say that Dr. Pierce is an important person in my family as well, for he has treated my family, and so it's nice for us to be on the same side today. So thank you.
Yeah, it is interesting how cancer really spreads it and affects all of our families in the same way we were struggling with autism in this committee as well. And it's the same thing. The more you talk about it, the more you realize how these important diseases affect all of us.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Fawn McNeely, and I'm here representing the ODS companies. ODS agrees with the comments made by both Regents and Providence, and we are in support of the bill. I participated as a member of the work group on Senate Bill 316, and it represents a collaborative consensus bill. We'd like to thank OHSU and the proponents for their willingness to address our concerns with the original bill, as well as Senator Devlin and Senator Bates and Senator Cruz both participated in the work group, and I think they were essential to bringing us all to a consensus document that we can support today. So thank you for your time. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great. Are there any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Is this a mandate bill?
Let's ask Mr. Powell.
Mr. Chairman, John Powell representing Regents again. Mr. Chair and Representative Maurer, this is a situation where it walks like a duck, but it swims like a fish. It really is what Regents believes was the situation prior to this bill passing. Not that they've always performed without making a mistake, but we think this should be the status of the law for a covered member, whether it's with Regents or any other insurer. I would define it more as a clarification of the benefit structure that we all think we represent.
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, I echo what John said. ODS believes that we do cover routine costs of care for clinical trials. I think this bill gives clarification to the issue so that the people who want to participate in clinical trials are able to proceed knowing that their routine costs of care are going to be worked out. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Maurer, my quick answer to your question is that I don't know, but if it is a mandate, we're in full support of it. For me, this is a clarification of how we intend to operate, how we hope to operate, how we aspire to operate, and how, in fact, we will operate. And so if it's a mandate, so be it. We're in support of it.
Comment?
Yeah. No, please.
I don't see this as a mandate. I see this as a contractual issue. And, you know, most people assume that when you sign a contract for certain services, that the contract is, in fact, going to cover those certain services. So I officially declare it not a mandate.
I'm glad to hear that. With that, before it gets worse, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 316A. We'll get it up for action pretty quickly. Let's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 16 and ask Dr. Natch and Dr. Kitchen and Keith Wolfhard to join us. We don't have a schedule.
Okay. So I'm going to have to step out and just see.
I'll take them.
Me too, I think.
Somebody else.
I'm done.
Pardon.
Oh, there you
You're
are.
Here? Okay, he'll guard the fort
right here.
Yeah, we don't have any work sessions.
Do we?
No, we have an informational.
Yeah, we have an informational hearing coming.
All right. Very good.
Oh, okay.
Let's go.
You want me to start? Hi, I'm Maureen Nash. I'm an internal medicine physician and a psychiatrist. I work full-time as a geriatric psychiatrist at the Tuolity Center for Geriatric Psychiatry, which is a referral center for all of Oregon. You know, in the last year, we've had folks from 23 of Oregon's 36 counties, and in the last 10 years or so, we've had folks from 28 of Oregon's counties. We see older adults, and many of the folks who come to us are people who have advanced dementia with behavior disturbance. This is an illness that the major risk factor for is age, and as we have a wave of baby boomers coming, there is really a tsunami wave of folks suffering from dementia approaching our shores. If you just want to talk about Alzheimer's disease, the most common kind of dementia, a 33% increase between 2000 and 2010 in Oregon. Between 2000 and 2020, a 58% increase. Between 2000 and 2025, a 93% increase in the number of Oregonians suffering from this illness. It's an extremely common illness. Many folks with dementia do require psychiatric care at some point. Fortunately, most folks don't have severe problems, but a significant minority do have severe problems. And a few of those folks get to a point where they are presenting a danger to themselves or others and require urgent or emergent psychiatric inpatient care. You know, a lot of Oregonians have healthcare proxies. They or healthcare representatives or medical power of attorneys. You know, people call them lots of different things, but they come to our hospital and they have these papers, and they filled out these papers often years ago when they were competent to make these decisions, and they appointed someone to make their healthcare decisions, and they come to us and they say, you know, I want my loved one to get care so that they can live in the community safely. And we have to say, well, I appreciate that, and we want to help your loved one, but you have no say as their healthcare proxy, because psychiatric care is specifically carved out of the healthcare statute in the state of Oregon. And I can assure you that 100% of people are unaware of that. You know, people have no idea. Their attorneys have told them that, you know, they do X, Y, and Z, and they've got all their legal bases covered. And people really are not aware that that this is a problem area. So then what are we faced with? Well, you know, in folks with dementia, many of them, a part of the brain doesn't work, the prefrontal cortex. It impairs a person's ability to have insight into situations. And it impairs a person's ability to understand whether or not they need help. And this is roughly two-thirds of the people with Alzheimer's disease have impairment in this part of the brain. So they don't know they need help, and so they often will say, I don't want help. And in Oregon, the way to get them help when they have an emergent psychiatric problem is either through a court commitment or an emergency guardianship, which is called a temporary guardianship. It's very traumatizing. You know, in my written testimony, I've sort of gone into some more details about it. But, you know, to have an 85-year-old put in handcuffs, you know, their hands behind their arms, and put into a sheriff's car and taken to a court where they think they're on trial so that their civil rights can be protected doesn't feel very protective. And it's very confusing and stressful. On the other hand, pursuing an emergency guardianship is very expensive and also very stressful. So I approached Senator Lori Mons Anderson about my concerns about this issue to see whether or not there was a way to change the laws in Oregon so that a healthcare representative could make psychiatric decisions, including hospitalization for someone who has dementia. And that is where this bill originated. You know, I have this conversation between 3 and 10 times a week with people who have healthcare proxies and their the family members who have a healthcare proxy.
When you started the conversation, why wasn't the conclusion just to delete subsection 1 of section 2? I mean, is there... Tina, are you going to have an answer to that one? Okay. Finish up, we'll get to
okay.
Dr. Kitchen.
I would just state there is... you know, there is a difference between dementia with behavior disturbance and most other forms of severe mental illness that might require inpatient care. And the difference is that 100% of people with dementia, if they do not die, will become incapacitated or incompetent. 100%. This is not true for people who have other forms of psychiatric illness, such as schizophrenia and bipolar disorder.
That's people who have correctly diagnosed dementia?
Yes.
Because with a policeman standing in front of you, you don't know whether that person really has dementia or not. I mean.
Sure. Well, I assume that, well, the police officers do what they need to do, in their opinion, to keep the general public safe, mm-hmm. which is a very different setting from, you know, inside of a hospital where
End-stage dementia is frequently misdiagnosed, as I'm sure you know.
It's often diagnosed very late.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't be interrupting you. My colleagues here have to keep me under control sometimes.
Okay.
Please finish up.
It never works, though.
Try. You got to try.
You know, I think I have my written statement, and I think that suffices.
Let's see if I can have enough discipline to let the rest of the panel talk before any of us ask questions. Dr. Kitchen, do you want to go next?
Mr. Chairman, fellow committee members, my name is Keith Wolford. I live in Oregon City. I don't have any fancy titles. All I am is an average citizen that votes, and I'm here to share my experiences, my personal experiences. Dr. Nash asked me to come and speak in favor of this bill because of my experiences with it. I'd just like to share some of those with you and tell you why I'm here today and how I got here. My mother, in her last 15 years of her life, had dementia. And because being the only child, I was responsible to take care of her financial and medical concerns because she was no longer able to do that. So I did what Dr. Nash suggested a minute ago. I attained all the proper paperwork to do that. I had the power of attorney for medical issues. I had the power of attorney for financial issues. And the same year that she passed away, my wife at 54 years old was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's, which Dr. Nash spoke to the fact that this seems to be an old person's problem. It's not. My wife was 54 years old. And at that time, I felt that I had the experience to handle the situation that was going to progress as her disease progressed. So I went and I got my power of attorney for medical needs. I got my power of attorney for financial needs, and things were running along very well and being able to handle those issues. Until at which time she became, she had some behavioral issues last year in the month of September. We had to get her over to where Dr. Nash performs her work, and at that time I was told that she couldn't stay there without a guardianship. And I said, "What do you mean?" I said, "I have everything that I need. I have a power of attorney, which allows me to take care of her medical needs and her financial needs." And I was kind of perplexed at why I needed a guardianship, and it was somewhat explained to me because this was a psychiatric geriatric facility that she was being admitted to, that I needed a guardianship because the state said they couldn't keep her there without her consent. She did not have the ability to make that consent. I was the one responsible for her care at that point. And it was very confusing and very frustrating for me to be told that I didn't have the necessary things to make that happen. Fortunately, in September, she wasn't there long enough to where we had to go through the full procedure. The doctor was able to put a hold on her, and that lasted for 2 weeks, and we moved on. Well, back in December of that same year, her progression got to the point that we were back over at Tualatin again, this time for a longer stay. And they told me at that point that I had to have a guardianship. And then again, I didn't really quite understand why, and it was pointed out to me again that that was the case. Well, anyway, long story short, I did attain a guardianship, but it's one of those things where those of us that are ignorant to these kinds of rules and laws, when we think we've got everything in place, it's just another hurdle and another hardship, not only emotionally but financially. And it seems very unfair for those of us that are trying to take care of our loved ones to be put in this position. I would suggest and hope that the committee supports the passage of this bill.
You're not alone, sir. This astounds me. So,
well, it was very frustrating for me as an individual to do what I just said I had to do, and I don't see a need for it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Kitchen.
Chair Greenlake, members of the committee, I'm Tina Kitchen. I'm the medical director for seniors and people with disabilities for the Department of Human Services. I think this is a very important bill. I honestly was also perplexed when I heard of the issue from Dr. Nash and from Senator Mona Sanderson. I had the privilege of participating in two different sessions as the Oregon Healthcare Decisions Act was attempted and then passed in 1993. And literally there were hundreds of hours of hearings that happened each session on this until it got passed. It was it's an extremely complicated piece of statute, and there are lots of important points of view that got put into this. And I can tell you that as that was written and as the public testimony happened, people with dementia was a driving force around why the statute was written. And in fact, there's special powers that are given to healthcare representatives for people who have dementia. On top of that, it was really meant to be an empowerment for Oregonians so that you could take your end-of-life decisions or the decisions that were going to happen to most of us as we become older and maybe lose our capability or we get hit by the Mack bus, the Mack truck outside or whatever, and we lose our capabilities. It was to empower Oregonians to appoint a person or to leave instructions for their end of life. And section, just to jump to Chair Greenlick's answer, question, on section 540 was put in because this was felt to be a tremendous amount of power that was being placed, that was allowing Oregonians to place in a loved one or a trusted one. There were certain groups that came forward and said that they needed those taken out of their authority. However, when one was placed in there, it really was placed by the advocates for people with serious persistent mental illness, the schizophrenia, the mental illness, the manic depression, etc. It was not placed in there by advocates of the dementia. And in fact, it was a very big surprise to me to find out that hospitals and others were interpreting this to say that that healthcare representatives did not have this authority. I think that a lot of us felt that they did have that authority. So the attempt was then to clarify the statute, and that's why you see 16A in front of you, that dementia is a progressive degenerative condition. It is not a mental illness, and therefore that this section doesn't apply. On this week, Monday, we started hearing of some concerns about this bill, and there have been some amendments that have been proposed. We just saw a different version than what we'd actually talked about last night right here at the hearing. So there are some amendments because I think there are some people that are concerned that this would authorize healthcare representatives to lock people away for a really long period of time. And I personally believe that when I appointed my daughter to be my healthcare representative, if I get into the point where I'm a danger to self and others and I need some psychiatric care even in a locked facility, I hope it's her that makes those decisions, to tell you the truth. And in fact, in that statute, in ORS 127.545, subsection 6, little a, it was actually placed in there that healthcare representatives would have power would supersede that of guardians. So, again, I was a bit surprised. However, on first blush at looking at those amendments, I think we can live with them, but we need more time.
And you're referring to the A2s?
Yes.
Thank you. Dr. Nash, I need to see you after the committee.
Okay.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and Bob Jundeff and David Niebel, if you want to come up at the same time.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff, and I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And like Dr. Kitchen, I had an opportunity to participate back in the 90s in the creation of the advanced directive statutes, not to the degree that Dr. Kitchen did. I was primarily representing a group of people who had mental illnesses and were concerned about how that legal structure would affect them, but also people with other disabilities who might use the directive. And I worked particularly with then Senator Shoemaker and his staff, who I thought did an exemplary job in dealing with an area that is very complicated and involves many different types of healthcare decisions, the most controversial among which are end-of-life decisions, but as you've heard, cover many other decisions, such as placement of individuals in healthcare facilities, nursing homes, adult care homes, hospitals, and so forth. Back then, there was a concern among certain individuals that this document not be used for the purposes of placing them in psychiatric hospitals. Just to give you a quick sense of that is that the feeling was that while I think a great deal of effort has gone into trying to have this document be as transparent as possible so that when people sign it, they know what they're signing, they know how it may be used. There's something about putting in a document that's primarily a person's using for situations that we've been discussing today, and it says, oh, by the way, we can put you in a psychiatric hospital indefinitely without any further process. Not only for people who might have mental illnesses, but for the average citizen, that might make a person pause about using that document because it sounds scary and difficult. There was a specific exception written into the law. And it was written in such a way that it says that the document cannot be used to place a person in a facility for mental health treatment. Segue to the following legislative session, and we still had the question of, well, should there be some sort of document for psychiatric care? And a work group was put together through Department of Human Services that addressed that very specific issue. And it brought people together, families, professionals, state representatives, and people with mental illness to discuss what type of document we should have. And that resulted in the creation of something called a Declaration for Mental Health Treatment. It sits in the same chapter as the healthcare directive. It's right after it if you look at that legislative chapter. And it has to do specifically with a person who wants to give advanced instructions for psychiatric care should they have a psychiatric emergency, lose the capacity to make decisions for themselves. And it allows a person to specifically indicate the medications that they might want to take and other forms of treatment, and it allows a person to consent in advance to up to 17 days of inpatient care. And I can tell you, having sat through many, many work group sessions on this, it was, again, there was many sensibilities. And the things that were reflected there, I'd say, is that people are, again, wary about signing a document that could, in their mind, indefinitely end them up in particularly the state hospital, because that's the one place you could go where cost is not an issue. If you go into a private hospital, you're not going to stay that long because the clock is going to be ticking, but you could end up in a state hospital for a long time. And people were concerned that they might somehow be coerced into signing the document, that someone, a treating professional might say, you know, if you want to have care here, we really want you to sign this, or, gee, we will let you out of the hospital, but only if you sign this document. So there was a lot of sensitivity around that. But that law was passed, and it has all those provisions and gives and takes in it, and we've lived with that for many years. I don't believe that in any of those discussions, dementia was ever a topic of conversation. And so I can say, I think, pretty confidently that that this great divide between mental health and physical health, the question of dementia was pretty much considered to be over in the physical health department. So when this particular issue came up, and I agree completely with Dr. Kitchen, is that in my estimation, this shouldn't have been a problem. I think that the law as it's written should allow for admission, but there are attorneys, my fellow attorneys, who disagree with me about that, and so we need to clarify how it works. And I think that this bill with the Dash 2 amendments does just that, while it also has some protections against the fear that I just mentioned, that fear being that somebody could end up in the geropsych unit of the state hospital indefinitely without it actually being what they thought they were signing up for, if you will. And so we do support Senate Bill 16 with the Dash 2 amendments. And I'll hand it over to Mr. Niebel unless there's any questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Niebel. I work for the Oregon State Bar, and I'm here representing the elder law section of the bar today. The elder law section is the proponent of the Dash A2 amendments. I think Mr. Junduff did a good job in describing the concern that they had about the bill in its current form, which is that it could allow a healthcare representative to place someone with a dementia diagnosis in a secure facility or a secure hospital indefinitely. And they felt it was important that this is, they agree that this is an important bill and that dementia is an extremely important issue to address, but they think it's important to put some limits on a healthcare representative's ability to place someone in a locked hospital facility indefinitely based on a diagnosis of dementia. And so what the Dash A2 amendments do is they allow for hospitalization for a period up to 17 days for behavior caused by dementia. And the way that Ms. Kitchen alluded to the fact that the amendments that came out were not the amendments that were proposed to the interested parties last evening. And it was basically legislative counsel figured out a better way to draft what we intended. So the amendment is adds something to the list of actions that a healthcare representative is not allowed to make, and so the language is the operative language in the amendment is lines 4 and 5, and it provides that a healthcare representative may not authorize hospitalization for longer than 17 days for behavior caused by dementia. So it puts a 17-day limit on that ability to place someone in those circumstances. And with that, I think I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Yeah, I have one. I'm an elder, so I hope the elder law section is representing me. And I want to give somebody the power to make healthcare decisions if I'm not able to make them. I want to give that to my wife or to my son or to somebody else. And I wonder why the law wouldn't allow me to do that. why there would be restrictions. I mean, why my wife, for example, couldn't decide that it was my best interest to be in a hospital for more than 17 days. She could put me in an acute care facility for more than 17 days. She can cause me to die. That's pretty tough. But I can't give her permission to put me in a psychiatric hospital. I mean, I don't understand that. You need to help me understand that. Why I don't have that right.
Chair Greenlick, I can give you my opinion of it in having worked through...
I'd like to have a legal opinion of it is what I want, rather than a personal opinion. I mean, I
can give you the legal
opinion
is that the law doesn't allow you to do it.
So all I have to do is delete subsection 1 of section 2, and the law will allow me to do it, and then it's okay, right? Why would anybody object? In fact, I'm going to request an amendment to do exactly that.
Mr. Chair, you could certainly do that. I think you will attract a great deal of opposition from people who feel that the document can be misused. There are people who are suspicious of documents of this kind. It's different in different cultural communities. Advanced directives are used much less among minority communities who don't trust mental health or healthcare professionals to make decisions for them.
We're not talking about healthcare professionals.
We're
talking about loved ones, right? I think it's perfectly fine if somebody doesn't want to give somebody a durable power of attorney about health. Fine, that's perfectly good. But I want to know why I can't do it.
Right.
If I don't distrust people.
And what I'm telling you is that many citizens feel that these documents can be misused and that people can be coerced into signing them and that there is suspicion of them. And part of the discussions that I participated in back when these laws were created was to strike a balance to make an attractive document, something that people would want to sign and feel that they could trust and that would not be abused. And this is one of the areas that got very sensitive. For one reason or another. Obviously, it wouldn't be for you as an individual, but it certainly is for others. And I think that when Senator Shoemaker and other legislators worked on that back in the 90s, that they were trying to balance the concerns about encouraging people to use an advance directive, allay fears that that document might be misused in a way that they don't want it to, because it's very difficult to place in the directive and the instructions every possible thing that might be done with it. I agree with you completely that there are many of us who would want to hand over whatever decision it is to a loved one and would feel secure in doing so, but there are others who have anxiety about that if the document allows a very broad breadth of decision making.
Well, I agree with Mr. Wolfhard. I find it astounding. And when I granted this power to my wife or to my son or to both, I don't remember who, I was assuming that they could act in my best interest, even in the likely possibility that I end up in a mental hospital.
One other thing that the literature has shown, and I agree with you that that's highly unlikely.
You said likely.
I was trying to help you. There's been some literature about how people sign documents and then actually change their minds later on, but then they have a document that it seemed to them when they were healthy and young and vital like yourself that they would want to do a particular thing.
Good, it's not bad.
And then when they end up in a different circumstance, things just look differently.
Well,
they look different to them, but now they've got a document. And that's
one
of the concerns.
Bring them on, because I'm going to propose that amendment to this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yep.
This may complicate the conversation, but the advance directive oftentimes is done many, many years in advance to its need. And Oregon has another system, the POLST, which is normally used after someone has been diagnosed with a terminal illness. I'm not making a direct comparison in this case, but the POLST, usually you've got a diagnosis and you sit down with your physician And usually the family member is there with the person in the room, and they're making some very conscious decisions about how things are going to proceed over the next, usually you're talking, most of the time it was 12 months, within 12 months. And why Oregon can't have a dementia pulse specifically for those, you know, because you know it's terminal. I mean, the conversation is much different. And why, you know, I guess I can understand the whole coercion that to me makes sense. But somehow, I don't know, is this the elegant solution?
Wait, ask that question so I know.
Is 17 days seems pretty limiting. I don't know what the where the threshold is.
Representative Greenlick, Representative Bauer, one of the things about this bill is it deals with psychiatric hospitalization, and in conversations at least I had with Dr. Nash and others is that generally acute care is only necessary for a short period of time, and that people with dementia are going to have longer term care in other venues, and that this bill as written would not affect that type of placement, the placement in the adult care home or the nursing home. It would only affect treatment in a hospital for acute psychiatric care.
Do you have a question? Let's go.
Yes. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt. There's someone waiting for me to step outside here, and I wanted to get clarification on this. In the proposed amendments, the 17 days, is that a single set of 17 days, or is this, if someone were in 4 or 5 days, three times each, does it add up to 15, and there are only 2 more days permitted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, as I read it, it's 17 days per incident, per admission.
Could someone else just as easily read it differently?
Mr. Chair, Representative Harker, I'd hazard a guess that the 17-day period is actually taken from the mental health statute, the mental health power of attorney statute, and that was a period of time that was deemed appropriate in that context, and so that's where the 17-day period came from, and I think that's probably per incident in the mental health statute, and that would be our interpretation.
Statutory reference for that.
It's ORS 125.736. I'm sorry, 127.736.
And that defines a separate power of attorney, a mental health power of attorney.
Representative Greenlick, there is in the same ORS chapter a set of law that has to do with giving advance consent to psychiatric care. It's called the Declaration for Mental Health Treatment, and it does allow a person to agree in advance to up to 17 days of inpatient treatment for acute mental health care.
Thank you.
Okay. I am going to prepare an amendment, so if we're going to have a hearing on that. Let's have it. That essentially deletes subsection 1 on section 2 in this bill, and we can have a discussion about it. Because I frankly don't understand. I mean, we don't trust people to make a decision on who can make decisions for them when they're not able to around psychiatric admissions. But we do trust them to withdraw life supports, to do all sorts of other things, to consent to dangerous surgeries. And we trust them to make that, but it's okay, I can give my wife that. But I can't give her the authority to make a decision about my admission or stay in a mental institution. It violates everything that I know about my personal autonomy, and it violates everything that I know about trying to make mental health and physical health one. I mean, it goes back to the stigmatization of mental health in a way that I find completely offensive. And I know about the snake pit days. I understand what used to happen in the 1890s and the 1920s, but we live in the 21st century now, and I need to have the autonomy to make these kind of decisions, and I need to make them when I can make them, not when I'm not able to.
Representative Greenlick, may I make one comment?
You may.
In considering your amendment, I would also consider the concept of transparency. The directive includes instructions and information so that a person is given written information about what they're signing. And I would just suggest that you consider that if you're thinking about eliminating that provision, that there'd be something in the instructions that would make it clear that that document can be used for that purpose.
I think that would be useful. I can tell you, I've signed that document, and it doesn't say that it does not apply with regard to psychiatric admissions.
Convulsive treatment.
Or
psychosurgery.
Or abortion, which I certainly would have worried about. No, I think if we are doing that, then we ought to have an option on all of those. I would agree with you. Under the assumption that person granting this authority is competent to grant that. I mean, that's the problem with doing it after they've been diagnosed with dementia. It calls into question whether at that point they're competent to make a decision.
Are they ever competent to make their decision?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm.
My only caution is you talked about the snake pit days. Well, in this building, we are still subject to the political snake pit.
Yes, and I think if
we want to jump in buck naked with both feet.
Yes.
and
my wife will say,
your wife would approve that.
No, my wife will say, you've gone over the edge and you can't do it. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to open an informational hearing on, let me see if I can find the agenda again. This thing woke me up. On improving health care. Employee and consumer safety. Improving healthcare employee. Yeah, it's about safety of healthcare employees. And I'm going to open up that public hearing, and the informational hearing, and I'm going to ask Linda Ennis, Chuck Esterly, and Marilyn Schuster to share with us. Is that the right panel, or would there be anybody else?
Michael Woods from Administrator Organizer here.
Okay, great.
Marilyn.
Great. Talk to us. I'm sorry we're late with this.
Chair Greenlick and members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us time for this informational hearing this afternoon. My name is Linda Enos. I'm the co-chair for the Oregon Coalition for Healthcare Ergonomics. I'm also the nursing practice consultant and certified professional ergonomist at Oregon Nurses Association. And today is Safety Break for Oregon, where we focus on safety and preventing injury in our workers in the state, and I think this is appropriate to be talking about the Oregon Coalition for Healthcare Ergonomics and the value of this diverse coalition in prevention of occupational injuries in Oregon's healthcare worker population. We've provided a handout for you, so I just want to hit a few highlights on our activities, who we are, and what we hope to achieve in the future. As you may know, work-related musculoskeletal disorders such as strains and sprains account for the greatest proportion of accepted disabling workers' comp claims in the state. A majority of those are in healthcare and occur with nurses and nursing aides in acute and long-term care facilities. And that's not surprising considering a nurse will lift 1.8 tons in an 8-hour shift, which is equivalent to a Subaru Forester fully loaded, and 450 tons in a year, which is about, 15 F-350s fully loaded, so we lift a lot cumulatively. However, it's not just nurses and aides that we're concerned about. We see MSDs and strains and sprains in other workers in healthcare, our diagnostic imaging technicians, pharmacists, laboratory workers, and housekeepers, for examples. The evidence base shows that by implementing ergonomics and safe patient handling programs, that we can not only reduce injuries and associated costs for these healthcare organizations, but
but we retain our workers and there's a value in recruitment. And then lastly, we are seeing early evidence that there's a positive impact on patient safety. You've just talked about dementia and Alzheimer's. You know, using equipment to lift a patient with dementia is a safer, kinder way and gentler way to move and lift a patient that can't move themselves rather than manually handling them, which is very scary for that population. To that aim, then, our coalition was formed in 2003. We were originally a sub-advisory group for Oregon OSHA, where we were discussing with them how to reduce strains and sprains in Oregon. And we finished that term and then formed the coalition in 2003. We're a working partnership between healthcare industry groups, including the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, Oregon Healthcare Association for Long-Term Care, professional organizations, academia, such as University of Oregon, labor organizations, workers' compensation, and Oregon OSHA. So you can see we're fairly diverse. I've been the chair since 2003, and I now co-chair with Deb Fell-Carlson, the Loss Control Program Advisor from SAFE. Deb is also an occupational health nurse. Our mission is to improve healthcare employee and consumer safety by promoting ergonomics best practices across a continuum of care, that is in long-term care, acute care, home care, and emergency medical services and beyond. Our goals, and we believe the way to do this is to promote education and awareness, share best practices in the state, and communicate an open dialogue between all the partners and stakeholders involved. Our overall belief is that staff safety, healthcare worker safety, is as important as patient safety, and the two are interrelated. And I don't believe we have that full picture understanding right now in healthcare anywhere, not just in Oregon. I'm just going to mention a couple of highlights from our activities in the past 5 years and those of our partner member organizations. We were the first. We held the first of a kind healthcare ergonomics conference in 2004, 6, and 9 in Portland. This was attended from people throughout the United States and throughout Europe, Australia, and Canada, and Russia. We have developed a lot of training materials with help from training grants from Oregon OSHA. These have been provided to all healthcare organizations throughout the state from funding from LURC and SAFE, and are used also in other states and other hospitals in the U.S. So we continue to develop a lot of educational materials with the belief we want to provide healthcare organizations with resources so they don't have to reinvent the wheel. Our coalition members provide a lot of consulting, OSHA, SAFE, Liberty Northwest, and myself at ONA have the privilege to work with our members and the organizations for a 1 to 2 year period for all of our healthcare facilities in Oregon, and I work with about 19 of them to date in the past 5 years. We've also impacted curriculum. We're very concerned that we change the way we're training our student nurses on AIDS around not just using good body mechanics to lift patients. So we've had success in this state to implement the National Safe Patient Handling Curriculum. ONA has facilitated that with OCHI, and we believe as of this year, 75% of our schools of nursing...
You didn't use quite those terms that
I'm sorry.
None of us know what they mean.
Sorry. So correct me again if I do that,
please.
Sorry?
OCHI
is the Oregon Coalition for Healthcare Ergonomics.
That's you. Okay.
You know, and it's the accent, too, you know?
So I thought you were talking about economics for a while.
Oh, but it strongly tied in, I am. Underlying on this. We think there's about 75% of schools of nursing have implemented this curriculum, which leads the rest of the states in this country. LURC has also worked heavily with EMS and firefighters in this state through training grants from Oregon OSHA. Lastly, one of our large projects that we're proud to talk about today is the unique facility of choice. We're partnering with Oregon OSHA to set up centers of excellence for safe patient handling in critical access hospitals, which is Good Shepherd in Hermiston and Dallas Nursing Home for Long-Term Care here in Salem. From these programs, which is supported by myself as an ergonomist for acute care and Jennifer Hestrom, University of Oregon, LURC, we're providing our technical assistance, and once these programs are implemented, other facilities can go and take a look and talk peer-to-peer and look at how these programs have impacted retention, recruitment, and injury reduction, and so on, in patient care. To date, Good Shepherd in Hermiston implemented their program last August. They've had no injuries related to patient handling, so we'll be monitoring that closely. So is it? What have we achieved in 5 years? It is too early to tell if the incidence and severity rate of strains and sprains has decreased due to some of our activities and our member organization activities, because injury statistics, as you know, are not reported in real time. They're usually about 2 years lagging. However, we do know that we have about 65% of acute care facilities in the state that have implemented safe patient handling programs. That's about 80% of our acute care inpatient beds. We know the national average, this is not reported officially, but through the American Nurses Association, is about 10%. So we're a long way ahead in Oregon, and we're very proud of that. We plan to conduct a formal survey of acute care with an independent body this year to look at exactly what's going on and what are the impact of these programs. Just so that you know what we're seeing anecdotally with programs such as in St. Charles Medical Center in Bend, they're seeing a reduction in injuries anywhere from 40 to 100% when we're using lift equipment and appropriate processes to lift and move patients. So, and I did want to talk about Multnomah County Health Department, Northeast Clinic in Northeast Portland. They put in some lift equipment, and they now have expanded their services to a greater variety of the population in Northeast Portland. They can lift and move the heavier or bariatric patients now. So it has these programs can have some unexpected positive outcomes as well. However, we've got a lot of work ahead of us. We plan to open up a website to share evidence-based best practices. Our focus for the next few years has to be long-term care and home health care. And we may be seeing our health care system in this country move towards more community-based care. Who knows what's down the road for us. But these two areas of health care have not done much with employee safety and safe patient handling, partly due to poor reimbursement. We cannot get reimbursement for electric lift equipment in home care. Some of the old legislation and rules is quite old, so newer technologies cannot be used by families and caregivers in the home environment. And we hope to conduct a future conference in partnership with Washington State and British Columbia to keep spreading the word about how to put in these programs and what the benefits are. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Chuck Easterly from Safe Corporation. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Hi, I'm Chuck Easterly. I'm the Loss Control Program Manager at SAFE, and I had the privilege of being a founding member of the Oregon Coalition for Healthcare Ergonomics. Since I'm going to refer to it as OCHE a couple of times, I'm sure, and
it's
just
okay
want to
now.
Remind you of that. I just wanted to start out, and our perspective is simply, why do we value this? What do we see in this organization? And we have represented behind me several members of our coalition. This is a dynamic partnership, and as we partnered with Oregon OSHA at the beginning of this, we wanted to find a dynamic way to collaborate on and share ideas, and getting a group that includes so many a wide breadth of experience, expertise, labor unions, the medical community, insurance. This has been a collaborative effort that actually problem solves. So we see it as a good working solution for the ergonomic issues facing the state, a model that can be used in other areas as well. But there were a couple of other things just from a high level. As we see it, as you can imagine, SAFE insures many types of businesses. Just from a perspective standpoint, when you think about material handling, you go out into the shops in manufacturing, a warehouse environment, and you're going to find that heavy equipment, things that weigh in excess of 100 pounds, are almost always moved using some type of mechanical aid. And that's to protect the person that's doing the lifting, and it's to protect that piece of equipment. And yet when you move into the healthcare environment, especially as we did back in 2002 and 3 when we were starting this, people do not have handles. They weigh exceptionally more than usually that 75 to 100 pound box. They can move in unexpected ways, and they are extremely more valuable than any piece of equipment you may be moving otherwise. And yet, in many cases, we don't use lift equipment for those. As we look at that opportunity, obviously, there's an opportunity to protect both the caregiver and that patient. And both of those people are very, very valuable. And we see the work of the coalition protecting both the patient and the caregiver and being a benefit to all Oregonians in that regard. And that gets us into that third part for us, and that's that one of the things that SAFE looks at is one of our visions is to make Oregon the safest place to work. And that is a lofty vision, but as I look at what will help us accomplish that, and it's collaborative efforts like this. And when I look at what our SAFE policyholders have benefited from the coalition, we have obviously benefited a great deal from the expertise of those, the people sitting at the table with me, the people sitting behind me. But beyond that, many other Oregonians have benefited as well. This is a this collaborative effort is benefiting people throughout the state, and I think it's one of the methods we're going to be using to actually fulfill our vision to make Oregon the safest state. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Michael and allow him to provide Oregon OSHA's perspective.
Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Michael Wood. I'm the administrator of the Occupational Safety and Health Division of the Oregon Department of Consumer and Business Services. I find it's easier to say I'm the administrator of Oregon OSHA. I'm a relative latecomer to this discussion, having only been in my position for a little, well, 3.5 years now. But these issues are issues across the country. And one of the things that I'm pleased to be able to bring here today is not only are we talking about a problem that is a very real problem, as of course most of the issues that get laid in front of the Legislative Assembly, folks are raising problems that are very real problems. I think we're also able to tell you that that we are in the process of addressing those problems and improving the situation. One of the real strengths of the Oregon approach to worker safety and health generally is its creativity. Another of the real strengths is our collaborative approach to many, many issues. And I think that the efforts of the Oregon Coalition on Healthcare Ergonomics are one of the places where you really see those coming together. And you see us moving forward in a way that, although, you know, we don't necessarily have the statistics yet, I think we'll bear fruit and we will get positive results and we will show actual change in injury and illness rates in healthcare. And hopefully not only injury and illness rates to workers, which is, of course, what falls under my jurisdiction, but also issues around patient safety, because when you're talking about the risk of hurting yourself while you are moving a patient, obviously there's a risk not only to the employee involved, but there's a risk to the patient as well. The two are, in some sense, inseparable. The practical reality is that this is about economics. It's easy to confuse ergonomics and economics. I actually am one of those people who believes that as a general principle, good ergonomics are also good economics. That's certainly true in healthcare. The practical reality is that we have seen injury and illness rates across Oregon industries go down steadily for the last decade. For the last 2 decades in many cases. We've seen a steady decline in injury and illness rates that covers almost every industrial sector. That shows up in the claims data that we track from the workers' compensation system. It also shows up as a general trend within the limitations of the data that's available on a state level from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. There is, however, an industry where there has been an exception to that overall trend, and that is healthcare. The injury and illness rates among workers in healthcare have not experienced the same kind of steady decline. And the reason they have not experienced the same kind of steady decline is because of issues related to ergonomics, related to a number of ergonomic issues, but primarily to patient handling. The practical reality is that the caregivers are getting somewhat older, and the patients are not only getting somewhat older, but also over the last 2 decades have gotten somewhat larger. And the risks involved in handling them has increased. That's an issue that we have to tackle if we are going to continue to have a viable workforce in healthcare and if we're going to be able to bring the workers' compensation costs within the healthcare system under greater control and show the kind of success that we have in other industries. I think the collaborative efforts of the folks represented not only by those of us before you, but by everybody who serves on the Oregon Coalition of Healthcare Ergonomics, are going to bear that kind of fruit. And I look forward to be able to show that with clear statistics and more evidence at some future date. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you a question, Linda. You mentioned the
you know, an interest in getting more involved with home care and community-based care.
Right.
And I see that as a real challenge and a real need. You know, I really agree with that. And I know that, you know, the home care workforce now is partly organized and partly unorganized, right? And there are some who are organized under the Home Care Commission, and then there are some who, as I understand it, are considered essentially domestic workers and thus not eligible for workers' compensation at all and nor training. And, you know, I'm wondering, is anybody tracking the injury rates among that population? And is this a big problem? I would imagine that it probably is a growing problem.
I would say it is a growing problem in all areas of healthcare. We know from the evidence underreporting is worse than any other industry. So I think you're right there. Chuck, can you address issues with workers' comp coverage for the healthcare,
well,
home care workers?
You are correct in that those covered by the Home Care Commission have workers' compensation coverage, and those that are not, I don't believe would be subject workers, and so there would probably be some. We would have no evidence of an underreporting because I don't believe there's a mechanism for them to file a claim if they don't have an employer. However, those people who provide home care under the home care realm within the Home Care Commission or for a private company, those are covered by workers' compensation. And I cannot comment on underreporting of injuries for those that we don't have records of.
Right, because the patient or client is their employer, and that's the challenge for the unlicensed home care workers. I think that's the population you're referring to.
Right. Yes, and I would be concerned, you know, as someone mentioned, the concern for the client as well, right?
Absolutely.
If the workers are not being trained in good ergonomics and are, you know, probably not, because I believe many of them are not covered by insurance, that, mm-hmm. and probably many of them are going without insurance themselves,
right.
Initial injuries are probably not being treated, and then I would assume that ergonomic problems become compounded.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're injured in trying to deliver care, you're probably going to screw yourself up even more,
right.
If I can use that technical
term. Or you lose your job.
That's a term of art.
You know. there is no good. We can't train the workers to do it more safely. We have to get equipment, low-tech tools and higher-tech tools in the home environment. The Facility of Choice grant in Hermiston, we're working with Home Health. The hospital is actually loaning equipment to members, family in the community. We think we're the first community in America to do this because there isn't the reimbursement. In Europe, there are warehouses where communities go borrow equipment and tools. And I think that's the approach that we have to look at for all of our home care workers, whether they're nurses or unlicensed personnel. Make the equipment available. We have to get creative. And that way we can truly address the injury problem, whether it's under report, whether we know about it or not.
I think this is a quite extraordinary presentation, and I have two reflections and one question of you. First reflection I find very interesting. I was involved, it must have been the late 70s or early 80s, working with the nurses at Kaiser Permanente. I was director of research for Kaiser on doing a research project that first documented the injury issues, and of course backs and strains were huge. And then in trying to teach the nurses ways to help prevent it, and it struck me, I don't think there was any discussion about equipment. I think it was all discussion about how to...
Body mechanics.
Yeah, it was about body mechanics. And it just struck me, how could that have been missed as a...
Well, we truly didn't have the evidence base as what was happening with the back when you lift a patient until about 5 years ago. Technology has also taken a leap forward. So this is very new still in healthcare. So that's probably why you didn't see the equipment back then, or at least some safe equipment.
Well, that's very interesting. The second reflection I have is, I think the new things on hospital compensation under Medicare will be excluding paying for things like the downstage results of a patient being dropped in a hospital.
Right.
I mean, you know, there's various surgical errors and a variety of other things, and I think that's going to be much more stimulation for hospitals to make sure they do this right if there's not
if they're going to be eating some of the costs of these kind of...
For patient fall prevention and then for wound, for skin abrasions too, and hospital-acquired pressure ulcers. That's another big area we see an impact.
And the other question is there anything statutorily that you need to foster this work as we get into the interim? We're going to begin getting our interim work, and are there statutory barriers to being able to move this forward, particularly ones that don't cost a lot of money?
Well, to be honest, you may have heard that there are eight states that say patient handling legislation, Washington being one of them. Some of them have had legislation for a long time. They have no data to show that that's actually worked. There is going to be federal legislation introduced in the next month from Representative John Conyers in Michigan. That's the second time it will be introduced. So, you know, we don't know where that will go in the future. For us right now in Oregon, we would like to see the Facility of Choice program expanded and grants offered to home care and long-term care organizations. We have the tools to give them. We can monitor the programs and successes and ensuring compliance to a point. But a lot of states that have legislation also offer grant monies. And we're talking $30,000, $40,000. We're not talking hundreds of thousands of dollars per facility that qualify. I think there needs to be an incentive for long-term care and home care, especially long-term care with grant-type programs, to get them off the ground where we can go and help them and go forward from that. And they can see the benefits in the program and hopefully invest in themselves and go forward in the future.
Well, perhaps we find a way to build that into workman's compensation and other kinds of areas. And OSHA, I mean, it is something. Let's continue to keep in touch over the interim. We're going to start our interim work when we close down in terms of this year's work, right. So we're going to be having some committee meetings in June while we're still all in Salem dealing with beginnings of an interim program. And it's been, I think, a very useful presentation. I really commend you on the work you're doing, and it's great to see agencies working together. And it seems great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time, all of you.
Anything for the good of the order? We are adjourned.